This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. World Suicide Prevention Day on September 10th is themed Connection, Communication and Care. Now, I know September 10th has gone by, but that doesn't mean that we can't continue to talk about the importance of suicide prevention, as well as the progress made by observing awareness days like this and the importance of social media in terms of shaping that conversation. I am, of course, joined in the studio by Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist. Dr. Philip, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Chui Lin. Nice to be here again.
Now, according to the World Health Organization, more than 800,000 people die by suicide each year. Do we know what the primary motivations for suicide are?
Well, actually, most surveys and research suggest that 90% of people who do end their lives by suicide have an underlying mental health problem. And the most common mental health problem is depression. So mental illness is one of the most common reason for suicide. Saying that, you still have people in crisis who may not have a long-standing mental health problem, but impulsively may resort to suicide. So I think we've seen that during economic downturns and, you know, when people get bad results in exams or when a relationship doesn't go as what they expected. And so impulsively, some people may resort to hurting themselves as a way of coping with stress, and sometimes that can go pretty bad and end up in suicide.
What is the typical suicide ideation process? You know, because for some people, it, as you point out, it's, you know, it's an impulse, it happens. Yeah. But for others, it might be months or even years of contemplating it before you follow through to carrying out the act. What is that process like?
Yeah, well, often it is what people describe as a narrowing of repertoire of what's available and what's positive. Everything's become so murky, gloomy, and negative, and they can't see out of that picture. Now, there's several reasons for that. One is it could be psychological, that perhaps they, you know, had a temperament that was a little bit more negative to start with, and they had bad experiences when they were young. But it can also be biological. So people with major depression, for example, have neurochemical changes that make them unable to actually look at the positive side of certain things. And so they may only perceive negativity in everything that they encounter. One of the main factors that have been identified in research is loneliness and hopelessness. And when people are hopeless, they end up, you know, in a position where they find that they need, the only escape is actually suicide. And so that takes several months, you know, with an underlying illness, for several months for it to build. And if people are not given the chance to talk, it festers and it gets worse, and then they may take, you know, action into suicide as well.
Right now, how far along are we in terms of creating awareness about depression and suicide? What are the main areas that people, you know, there's still a lack or a gap?
Yeah, I think there's a huge gap. I mean, the 10th of September went, and I don't think anybody talked about World Suicide Prevention Day. You know, every other World Day is highlighted. It's, you know, in the media. It's splashed in all the newspapers. It's, you know, you've got seminars and conferences. We had nothing this last 10th of September. And it's really sad because most of the communication is actually behind closed doors. People talk about depression behind closed doors. People talk about suicide behind closed doors. Families who've experienced their family member die from suicide are trapped in this closed door. Nobody wants to talk about it. You know, we've got a big open communication going on about obesity and diabetes, and everyone talks about it like, you know, it's the most important thing. I got to change my diet. I got to do my exercise. I got to do this. But we haven't started talking about other common conditions like depression, which is just perhaps as common as diabetes, but more disabling and with worse outcomes. And, you know, I think it's something that we need to start thinking. Are we just brushing it under the carpet, pretending it doesn't exist? Or can we maybe get matured in our thinking and say, this is something we need to communicate and talk about?
Do we know what the numbers are like here in Malaysia for people living with depression or people who have attempted suicide?
Well, the latest National Health and Morbidity Survey that was done in 2015 gave some shocking results. Apparently 29% of Malaysians have a mental illness. That's adult Malaysians. Now, this is a stark contrast to 2011 when it was just about 13%. We almost doubled in just a period of 2 or 3 years. 4 years. Now, maybe there was some bias in the way it was conducted, or maybe last year was not a very good year to do a study, especially on depression. But the fact remains, it is on the increase. It's been increasing with every National Health and Morbidity Survey. And we still don't talk about it as much as we talk about other medical conditions. And then there's suicide. The only statistics that we have officially is from the National Suicide Registry, which started up in 2008. And then all of a sudden, 2009, it stopped. I believe, I'm not... I stand to be corrected, that it was an issue of funding. But it shows, you know, the amount of importance that people have put to it. But from that registry, it was, I think it was difficult for people to get the information, because most people in Malaysia, if somebody does die of suicide, that's not what's going to be written in their death certificate. Family members are going to try hard to prevent that from actually being written or put down as suicide. Because one, it's a crime in Malaysia, one few countries in the world that criminalizes suicide. And second, it's a big taboo and stigma for the whole family for years on, you know. So sudden death sometimes is written off as myocardial infarct or, you know, infection or something else, when really is suicide. And so we don't really know the numbers, but what's suggested is about 2.6 per 100,000 population in Malaysia in 2009.
If you've got any questions or stories about suicide today, give us a call. We're talking about suicide prevention and suicide and culture. That number is 03-77-109,000. You can text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. In terms of that taboo, I think another area that people don't really like to talk about is the fact that in almost every part of the world, men kill themselves at higher rates than women. Mm. Why does that happen? Do we know?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is in stark contrast to the fact that women actually suffer from depression more than men do.
Is that just a matter of self-reporting? I mean, maybe people are more willing to talk about it.
You're right, yeah. I mean, it could be. It could be that women actually seek help early and then get, you know, higher in the statistics because they actually... willing to talk about emotions and thoughts, and men don't. They hide it because it's like a man thing not to talk about these things. They think of it as a weakness. But a neurochemical change in the brain is not a weakness, it's an illness. The other reason is, of course, suicide is very commonly associated with substance use. So one of the most lethal combinations is depression with substance use. And the gender that actually has higher risk of substance use in combination with depression is males. They have perhaps suicidal ideas because of the depression, but together with substance use, then they get the courage and the impulsivity increases, the inhibition
goes down.
Yeah, and so they succeed in committing suicide. One of the other factors also is the mode of committing suicide. So a lot more men would use methods that are, really hard to survive with, jumping off a building or hanging or standing in front of a train. And a lot more women may use methods such as overdose or poisoning, which sometimes people, if attention is brought early, survive, and you know they don't go on to this whole suicide.
If it's something that a person wants to do. I mean, we have seen assisted suicide get crackdowns all around the world. You know, people are concerned about. Of course, exactly that, the idea that you might be pushing someone to do something they don't want to do, you might be enabling suicide. Where do you stand on this? You know, why is suicide problematic if it is in fact something that a person wants to do?
Well, because suicide is preventable. 90% of suicide is related to a mental illness, and that 90% is treatable. people actually recover. And that's the communication that we need. You know, the sad thing is on the internet, we've got millions of sites teaching people how to kill themselves. And maybe, you know, half of that telling people where to seek help for suicide or suicidal thoughts. And there are many suicide, survivors who have described and talked about how you can actually recover. You know, there. I mean, if you listen to the TED Talks, there are several wonderful talks. There's one I remember about the Golden Gate Bridge, somebody who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, survived, and now is a huge inspiration for others, especially young people who, you know, at the end of their tether and thinking about suicide as well. So we need to listen to the positive stories. We need to listen to hope that, you know, and the social media doesn't do justice being able to deliver that.
Let's talk a little bit about the places that this happens. I mean, why is suicide such a recurring theme in certain societies, for example, the Koreans and the Japanese?
The Koreans of late have actually outnumbered many other countries in terms of suicide. I think that some of the factors that I've heard, I've actually got a close friend, we studied together in Australia, and he's actually the national coordinator for suicide prevention in Korea, in South Korea. And he's communicated to me as well about some of the issues that he thinks are relevant to why the figures are really high. One is that, of course, their aging population is on the rise. And as they age, they are becoming more isolated. So a lot of these suicides are in the rural areas, and especially among the elderly. The children move, and because of the fast pace of life, there's very little connection and contact with some of the children, and so they get isolated. And they have the highest number of losses at that age group. Spouses passing away, you know, close relatives, friends. Their physical health deteriorates, so that's a big loss. And they may be on medication that increases their risk as well. The elderly also are higher in the lower socioeconomic levels in Korea, and so that's another factor that increases their risk. But I think they also live with this culture that if they're becoming a burden to others, then it's acceptable to do something for the good of others. So an altruistic reason for why they should leave becomes pivotal in their minds. And that happens in Japan as well. I mean, I think there's the thing called the karoshi, which is, you know, overworked Japanese people who then feel if they can't cope anymore that the next best thing to do is to leave and leave the world. And it's an altruistic thing that I think needs more education, needs more support, network, and, you know, changes to how things are run on a day-to-day basis in terms of work and other, you know, community activities.
We have a call on the line from Pochi. Good afternoon, Pochi.
Hi, can I speak to Dr. Philip George, please?
Yep, he's right here.
Yeah, hi, Pochi.
Hi. I totally disagree that people who attempt commit suicide should be fined or even to put into jail, because when a person is up to the stage of committing suicide, they are really, severe depression.
Yes.
And putting them into jail or fining them will not solve the solution.
Yep.
And the thing is, sorry?
No, please go ahead.
Do we have trained staff that is trained in handling people with that attempt commit suicide? Mm. And do we have a counselor that goes to the family where we have such victims? You know, to put them in a psychiatrist's ward or to find them, it's totally inhumane.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question, Pochi.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
I think Pochi has brought up a very important issue. I mean, I think criminalizing suicide actually is just making the whole situation worse. People talk about it less. People don't even want to come out and seek help because they're worried that they'd be criminalized and, you know, that put them in jail or, you know, the family's going to be stigmatized. So, yeah, I completely agree. I think we need to think of it as a health issue, not a criminal act. You know, and then we need to address it in the appropriate ways with health-related techniques and measures. Admission to a psychiatric ward is sometimes essential in people who are highly suicidal, and that's to provide them a safe environment. Of course, I am a little disappointed that maybe our psychiatric wards are not as good as, you know, the wards that you have for people with heart disease. You know, they don't have curtains and lovely little things around them to make people feel that they're in an environment that helps for recovery. And there's a lot that can be done. I think it's also funding that can support and help this. But essentially, it may be important in the first few weeks when people are being assessed for their suicidality and, you know, maybe started on some therapy and treatment, because it's those first few weeks that the suicidality is the highest.
I'm speaking today with consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip George. We're talking in conjunction with World Suicide Prevention Day, which fell on September 10th. But we're still talking about it now because it's important to discuss
it. I think we're only starting to talk about it now.
That's true. We've addressed it before here and there.
Yeah,
but
that's true, yeah.
But you know, today's show is all about that. And if you've got any questions or stories, if you're concerned about somebody, if you're seeking help, our phone lines are open. That number to call, 03-7710-9000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me, Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist, and we're talking about suicide today. Our phone lines are open. If you'd just like to talk, give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We haven't talked about bullying, but there have been reports that shows that bullying precedes suicides, particularly among a younger group of people. Could you elaborate on that correlation?
Yeah, so self-esteem is a real important factor in protection of suicides. And self-esteem is usually nurtured in toddlership. I mean, if there's such a word.
Toddlerhood, I think.
Okay. Yeah, by parents. And so, you know, the parent that goes, "You stupid child, you useless, you're..." is going to affect the building of that self-esteem in that child. I mean, if the child does something wrong, then it's best to criticize that behavior rather than the child. Of course, as the child grows, then in teenage life, the people responsible for their self-esteem is their peers. And if they get into an environment where bullying is a norm, or, you know, they're different from others, they have a funny name, or they look a little funny, or they're a little obese, and bullying occurs, then that self-esteem starts to, you know, be shattered to some level. So it's important for children to have buffers. You know, I mean, no one's perfect, and there is going to be an opportunity for something to be done in school that is going to affect people. But if they have buffers, like parents who understand and, you know, who can talk to them and open communication, or siblings who they can spend time with, or, you know, maybe exercise that they're doing regularly, activity that helps to build their, you know, their themselves in different areas of life skills, then, you know, it provides support for that so that it doesn't become pivotal in, you know, leading up to low self-esteem and then suicidal or suicidality.
The problem with buffers is that it used to be that you could leave your bullies behind in some ways. You know, you come home, or if your bullies are at home, sadly, you go to school. But the point is, there are ways to avoid it. But now cyberbullying is relatively new, but very common.
Yeah.
Are the current approaches to suicide prevention caught up to this new influence when it comes to suicide-related behavior?
Sorry, excuse me. Yeah, well, in Korea, they actually have online sort of guardians who monitor this. And so they've seen the need, because the rates of suicide there have actually increased so dramatically that they've decided that they will be proactive and, you know, get online and monitor bullying that actually happens and then provide support to those kids who, you know, may be victims as well. I think it's important to look at, you know, exposure in social media. So, I mean, parents will know their kids, and they'll know if somebody is a little bit more fragile, a little bit more vulnerable, then reliance on social media may need to be appropriate. You know, the amount of time they spend, and you know, parents can do, create other activities that will actually help build the self-esteem, rather than letting the social media play that role. And so, I mean, there are kids who may be vulnerable and who, you know, invite or encourage bullying through means that they don't know, and that can then happen in social media as well. And so it's a double-headed sword. It, you know, it doesn't become a protective factor anymore. In fact, it adds on to the, you know, to the misery as well.
So how can parents, I mean, it's very difficult to control social media. That's the point. You know, you don't always know everything that's happening in your child's online life. And some might argue that you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't exactly intrude into that space. So where is the balance then for parents who want to understand what their child is getting up to, want to make sure that they're not falling into trouble, but at the same time wants to respect boundaries?
I think the important thing is communication from the beginning, getting them exposed to what to expect. They're not everybody out there in the World Wide Web is going to be nice and fantastic and friendly and who they really are. So that communication needs to be expressed the moment you give a gadget to your child. I mean, I see kids, the youngest two, who are getting gadgets and playing in restaurants and other things. And I think of it as, you know, largely a surrogate babysitter that the parents are resorting to. But if you haven't briefed them and told them what to expect, to anticipate, and you know, then you're doing an injustice by providing a gadget and trying to pretend to everyone else that you can provide more than they can. It's a huge injustice. So I think they need to prepare their children for the positives and the negatives, and then get them to think about also having an open communication. If something's not going right on your social media, I don't want to be there policing and, you know, being on your side, but you talk to me. You know, I'm here to help.
There have also been an awful lot of stories about people being encouraged to commit suicide online. You know, some people have actually committed suicide live on video. You have had cases in the US where teenagers have been tried for encouraging other teenagers to basically kill themselves. And when I would imagine for a depressed person, when they finally meet somebody who is encouraging, even though it is encouraging in the area of, you know, suicide, you would still feel comforted by that. How do you deal with that? Is that the next big hurdle to suicide prevention, the fact that there are these websites, there are these people?
I mean, I was maybe just digressing a bit. I was just listening to a TED Talk and this suicide survivor described how he was on the bridge and about to throw himself off, and I think the police came, and he was just had this glimpse or thought of, shall I change my mind? And then somebody on one of the onlookers shouted out, go ahead, you coward. And then he, you know, jumped, but somebody's hand reached out and grabbed him before he could actually complete the jump. So you have your share of the positives and the negatives. They're all there. They're out there in the community. In fact, we know the World Wide Web has more negatives than positives, especially in the area of suicide. So I think it's important to, you know, to rely on the appropriate supports and networks. And there are networks and supports that can actually help people and to know that it is preventable. I mean, there are a couple of other things that when people are encouraging others, it's often, you know, the same sort of peer pressure that builds as you're growing up and wanting to be part of a group and you want to be accepted. And sometimes you're pushed into doing something just to be accepted in a group. And so they need to know that there are other avenues of being accepted, and, you know, they need to have their buffers as well.
We have a caller on the line now. Good afternoon, Ruslan. Hi, your question?
Yeah, my question is drug addiction also contribute to the suicidal, and how many percent?
Thank you, Ruslan.
Thanks, Ruslan. Yes, drug abuse does increase suicide risk. We don't have the percentages in Malaysia, but we do know that people with the mental health problem and drug dependence have maybe about two or three times higher risk of suicide. So, for example, if in depression the risk of suicide is 10 to 15%, that increases to 20 to 30% with drug use. There's certain types of drugs that actually increase suicidality even more, and they're called the CNS depressants. So those that cause depression in the brain, they may cause the, you know, euphoria and everything, but overall they do cause depression in the brain, and that also can increase the risk of suicide as well.
The question that we always ask when it comes to depression and suicide, and I think I've asked you this before, probably every time we've talked about a situation like depression, is how do you help those who don't want to be helped or who are not asking for help? Because it's one thing to tell somebody, hey, you need help. And that usually doesn't go well, I think, by any measure. And it's quite another thing for somebody to realize, okay, maybe I need to, I need to talk to someone.
So, I mean, that's the theme for the World Suicide Prevention Day: connect, communicate, care. And I think all these three things are not easy to do when you think that somebody's having depression or suicide. You rather maybe avoid talking to them. You rather maybe not broach the subject. You're worried that if you ask them, are you thinking about hurting yourself or harming yourself, they'll say, "Oh, I didn't think about that. Let's go kill myself." But the fact is, if somebody does connect with them and if somebody does communicate with them, they actually reduce risk of suicidality. So, yeah, so I think it's important if you're with someone. I mean, I think this is really common, you know, when you're a university student, your roommates, you know, you're all together, you'll notice somebody is a bit different. You know, they may be more sulky or angry or, you know, maybe isolating themselves more. You want to connect with them. And that's what we're asking people to do. Don't push them to go and see a professional. Don't push them to go and do things that they feel even more scared of. But connect and then communicate. And that's everyone's responsibility.
Sadly, though, some people, I mean, earlier you mentioned that some people view depression as weakness. And similarly, I think some people view people who are emotionally difficult, shall we say, as burdens. And that's where that whole idea of I'm a burden, you know, comes from, because sometimes people treat you as a burden or a liability. How would you advise people to get over that hump? Because I can imagine somebody looking at somebody else and thinking, you don't look like fun. You know, you look sulky. I don't want to reach out to you and I'm not concerned about you. How do we encourage that sense of, look, just because somebody is not the happiest person in the room doesn't mean we should avoid them?
Well, not all people are born that way. You know, they don't go through life, the whole life, in that sort of, you know, pattern. And usually with depression and with suicidality, there's an onset of these symptoms. So you can remember them when they were fun and happy and, you know, friendly and all of that. And there's no reason why you should only think of them currently when they're negative and feeling down, as that's who they are. Because that's what they are starting to think about themselves, which is not true. And so you need to point this out, you know. You need to tell them, you remember the time when we went for dinner and we had a good time and we did this, and, you know. So, you know, things don't look the same with you. And I'm concerned. And I'd like to help if you feel that it's appropriate.
We're talking about suicide and suicide prevention specifically. If you've got any questions or stories or you just want to talk, give us a call. That number is 03-77-109000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Sadly, you know, if nothing works, if you don't manage to offer help in time, or, you know, just if it just happens out of the blue, for those who have lost a loved one to suicide, is it fair to say that the bereavement process is maybe more complicated than usual?
Yes, yep, you're right. It is more complex. And that's largely because of what society and, you know, the discrimination and the stigma all do to suicide and depression and the whole mental health arena. So if we can be more comforting, in fact, I'm sure most of us, if we look closely, be somebody that we know who had a close one, you know, maybe lost to suicide. And we need to provide them even more support, because for them, it's not easy going through it alone. So I think it's important to provide more support. It's important for them to be able to talk about it as well and process it in their minds as well.
Is it possible for grief, relief, and anger to go hand in hand? I mean, how do you work through that process? Because on the one hand, grief is, of course, present. Yeah. Relief might be there because you might think, well, at least this person finally has peace, you know, from their sadness or their pain. Yeah. But you might also be angry at their selfishness for not thinking of you and everyone else they left behind. Yeah. How do you work through those feelings?
Well, I think it's important to, I mean, not wallow in the reasons why and, you know, the whole process of that suicide, but maybe to focus on the positives that they experience with that individual, because that's how they would want you to remember them as, with as well. And, you know, maybe, well, I mean, being able to process, anger becomes one of the, stages of grief. And sometimes if people do die from suicide rather than natural causes, then that anger may be prolonged. But there are ways to relieve that through grief work and through maybe professionals as well.
With that stigma, sadly, I mean, hopefully it dissipates over the years, but at this point in time, it's definitely present. You know, you speak of, oh, they're that family whose son, you know, and things of that nature.
Yes.
How do you move on from, how do you move past that?
Well, I know some family members who have had their family pass away from suicide who have tried to give to others. And so they talk about their stories and they destigmatize and, you know, demystify this whole depression and suicide and get others, you know, so I've heard of one family who actually helped another to see the risk of suicide in their own child and then actually confront the child and help prevent a terrible event. So giving back is one of the ways that they can help to overcome this. Of course, again, it's, you know, the whole stigma and everything that happens here. It's not so easy. But we have NGOs that actually can provide the avenue and the opportunity to provide that support as well.
What can we all begin doing to start removing that stigma, you know, bit by bit? Because I think it's important, because it's one thing for doctors such as yourselves to say, oh, we need to remove the stigma. But ultimately, it's going to be a society who removes that, you know, block by block, bit by bit.
Yeah. I think it's important to first be literate, mental health literate. You know, when we talk about, cholesterol is the most common cause for heart attack, we all read about, you know, what diets can reduce cholesterol, what are the tablets or, you know, exercises that we can do to reduce our risk. But we do very little in terms of mental health literacy. We don't read up. We don't connect with activities that actually help our mental health. We don't do mental health hygiene. You know, we do all the hygiene that we need. We bathe ourselves. We brush our teeth. And so we do dental hygiene. We do physical skin hygiene. But we don't spend time every day to look at what were the positive things that happened in the day and what were the not so positive things and how can I better deal with them, you know, in the following day. And we don't build our social skills and networks to help our mental health as well. So I think that's an area that we need to start talking about and, you know, build in ourselves as well.
And what would your message be for World Suicide Prevention Day?
Well, I have a message for next year's World Suicide Prevention Day. Actually, the Malaysian Psychiatric Association is organizing the 29th World Congress of International Association of Suicide Prevention. And that's from the 18th to the 22nd of July 2017 in the Borneo Convention Center in Kuching. It's not just for healthcare professionals. It's open to all volunteers, people who, you know, have an interest in trying to help prevent suicide, and all aspects will be covered, the psychological bits, the social bits. We've even got a speaker called the Golden Gate Bridge Keeper, and he goes up and down the Golden Gate identifying people who are, you know, trying to throw themselves off and talking to them out of it. I believe we've got somebody like that in the Penang Bridge who rides his motorbike up and down and has helped two or three people survive. So, yeah, so I think it's something that's open to everyone, and make a date, try and come for this Congress. But also learn more from the Befrienders, which actually is non-religious. It provides support 24 hours on by telephone. And it's for people who may be feeling down or feeling suicidal. I can give their number if that's all right. The Befrienders is 03-795-68145. So that's a 24-hour line in KL.
Thank you very much for coming in, Dr. Philip.
Thank you, Shilin.
I've been speaking today with Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist. We've been discussing suicide prevention, particularly for World Suicide Prevention Day, which is observed on the 10th of September every year. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.